Hello and welcome to the Nasbinum Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me Billy Morrison, guitarist, actually also bass guitarist, singer, actor.
I'm going to stop you right there. Here's the bane of my life, Phil. I was in the cult for a little over 2 years, right? Yeah. I've been in Billy Idol's band for 15. Yeah. And everything I've done, I'm a guitar player. And everyone goes, bass player of the cult, we're scrubbing that. I'm a guitar player. Yes,
okay. Guitarist also. Okay, we'll underline that as a guitarist because obviously Gibson gave you your own signature guitar as well.
They did, yeah. I was Gibson and now Nags. Nags are a hand-built, bespoke guitar manufacturer in America, and I have a brand new signature out with them. Steve Stevens plays Nags as well. So I've had a Gibson, I've had a Nags. I'm quite honoured.
Absolutely fantastic. Now, this is going to be your third solo album called The Morrison Project. It comes out, I think, on April the 19th. Is that worldwide?
That's correct. That's correct.
And there's 12 original tracks, but obviously there's a theme flowing through all these songs. This is an angry, determined, observational album, isn't it? There's a lot going on here.
There is a lot going on, and I love that you use the term observational because I try not to be too opinionated, but I do observe everything. And, you know, the nature of this record, it all came about COVID and post-COVID, pandemics, riots, financial ruin everywhere. It's not exactly going to be a positive, uplifting record if I'm just observing, you know. So. Yeah. We've all been through that, and I didn't think I was going to make a record. I was just making music because COVID, why not? I have a studio in my house. And so I was throwing all kinds of random genres and elements together because I wasn't thinking I need to write a single or I need a cohesive sound. And I believe that's why the record came out sounding so good, because it was honestly truthful from my heart, the kind of music that I enjoy listening to. All of it, you know, even the piano ballad with Linda, you know.
Yeah.
There's everything from hip-hop to David Bowie to metal to EDM. It's all in this record.
So when the writing process, because you're recording this in your home studio to start with, were you primarily writing on guitar then? And if you were, what I'm interested in is because some of these songs are really high-energy rock songs, did you visualise the drum and bass sound in your head as you formulated, as you pulled the chords together?
So yes and yes. These days, I mean, my studio's really nice. I'm very fortunate. So 80% of this record was recorded and done, finished here. I love programming drums. As a guitar player, I'm not a drummer, you know, so all the drums were live drums but farmed out to the drummers that played on it.
Yeah.
But in order to show them what I wanted them to do, I programmed the drums, and I love doing it. And so I pride myself on my program drums sounding pretty much like a live drummer. And so I would record, depends on the song. Drowning, the first single, I had that main riff, and so I built the whole 16 bars, bass guitar, drums, multi-layered guitars, the lead line over the top. So it was just that 16 bars. Another song I might just, like Chasing Shadows, the piano ballad, I wrote that all on piano first, you know. Yeah. But yes, the answer is I've always got the instrumentation that I hear in the back of my head. And I guess that's what makes a songwriter is you've got to be able to hear past E, C, G, D. You've got to hear what the other instruments and the drums and all the rest of it. So I love that process.
Yeah, because I mean, that track, Drowning, obviously it's a great video as well. It starts with a brilliant bass riff, great groove, isn't it, with the drums. It's full of attitude, and it's all about almost like drowning in negativity, and it's just great. I mean, opening song, isn't it?
Thank you. I hope that other people identify with that feeling at the time. I felt information overload. We were all locked inside. We were all watching all of our politicians on both sides tell us a bunch of information each day that changed every day they would go, oh, actually, it's not that, it's this.
Yeah, yeah.
There were riots. It was just information overload, and I felt like I was drowning in negativity. And hopefully other people will relate to that, you know. And that was one of those riffs. You know, sometimes a song takes weeks or even months to fully gestate, if you like. That one was done in about 20 minutes. I wrote the original riff with Jordy from Marilyn Manson's band and Eric Eldenius, our drummer. And we knew, you get a riff like that, you're like, well, that's pretty much it. You know, that is a winning riff. So thank you.
Because talking about how you program the drums, about the 3 minute mark, it kind of falls back to just like percussion, doesn't it? There's like that, which I
it's
absolutely
an industrial
love that.
Loop.
Yeah.
There's like a distressed loop. I mean, you get that from Trent Reznor. You know, Trent is the master of building stuff up and bringing it down. And even with the live drums, there's a couple of loops running through that song. And you just hear the high end, and it just gives it more of a mechanical feel, which I wanted for that.
That's great. And I love the way it comes back after that and goes into this guitar solo. It's fantastic. Great track.
Thank you. I mean, I'm not a lead guitar player per se. You know, I have to stop saying that.
I think you are. I think you have some moments on this, Billy.
Well, I'm quite proud of it. I am quite proud of it because I've never looked at myself as a lead guitar player. I'm certainly not the Yngwie Malmsteen of this world, but not every solo needs to be a million notes a second.
No, because what you do, and I think this is, what I'm trying to say is that because you're known as being the rhythm guitarist and you're writing the songs, the way you've done the solos on the ones where you do play, that the notes are all, they all serve the song. They're not coming from a point of ego, are they? They're serving the song.
I love that. I love that. And you're absolutely right. I don't really, look, there is a place for the ego-driven solo, for sure. I, along with the rest of them, love to watch someone who can really shred just do it. But for this album, for this sonic structure, if you like, that I built, the notes do need to serve the song. And I have literally no ego around my lead guitar playing because I'm a newcomer to lead playing. So I would like to think, yes, the notes serve the song. There are a few examples where I tip my hat to certain lead guitar styles. There's a piece, I believe it's The Sound of Freedom, where I do the Iron Maiden twin guitar thing, you know, just because I've grown up, I've listened to Iron Maiden, and I'm like, oh, this could be maybe I play a solo and I then hear, oh, I could do the Iron Maiden thing there. You know what I mean? It's what I'm not doing is just blindly riffing to show how good I am, because that would fail.
No, that's great. I made an on the Sound of Freedom. I'm actually put down and put in brackets of thought. Another great guitar solo. Must ask if that's Billy. It's great. Now, the next track, Crack Cocaine.
Yes,
now,
sir.
This features Ozzy Osbourne. And the music, it starts off with that blues acoustic stuff, which draws you into this false impression of, I wonder where this is going. And then you have this bone crunching kind of like pinched harmonics riff that you think the only person who can do this is going to be Ozzy Osbourne. How did you get involved? I know you and Ozzy are great friends. So did this song feel as if it just was going to be Ozzy?
You know, Steve Stevens and I do a lot of writing together. Obviously, we've been in a band together for over 15 years, and we're kind of telepathic now with guitar parts. You get that when you play with each other and you're not playing the same stuff, because in Idol, the idea is two different guitar players, two different guitar parts. I learn that Steve's going to do this, so I'm going to go underneath on this inversion, and it's telepathic. So me and Steve were writing one day at his old place in Los Angeles, and we had detuned guitars. We were messing around on the drop tuning, Aussie tuning guitars. And between us, we came up with this riff, and laughingly, you know, Steve says, "Oh, dude, this is like the Aussie riff that never got written, the classic Aussie riff.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously, Aussie being my best friend, I went, "Well, hang on a second." And we sent it to Aussie. And his response was, "My God, I love this." And, you know, very soon, Aussie was up at Steve's with us and we wrote the song, the three of us together in a room, which also, that's a key. The three of us, me, Aussie and Steve, in a room. Aussie's writing lyrics. Me and Steve are pinching harmonics. There's a chemistry that happens that you don't get unless you're in a room together, you know?
Would you, I'd also probably want to take that further, because although I think being in a room together is such a almost novel thing in the way that a lot of music is put together nowadays, people are in other corners of the world, is that even though that you might have people in the room, sometimes people have got to get to know each other and feel their way around stuff. You're all friends.
Yeah.
So that you all know each other. So there's no kind of worry about egos or what will they think of this. Everyone's just themselves.
Well, that's also when they talk about a moment in time when a really classic song gets written. And I'm not comparing Crack Cocaine to the wonderful classics that we have. But there was something that happened when we wrote that based upon there was zero ego. There's no ego. Me and Aussie have been best friends for nearly 30 years. Steve knows him really well. Aussie loves Steve. So the three of us in a room, there's no pressure. And again, we weren't writing for a record. There was no pressure. We came up with a great Aussie type riff. Aussie likes it. So I think that was one of those moments in time. It clearly was, because that was written before COVID, and Sharon was the one. It's so generous of Sharon. She's the one that said, "We like this. Aussie and I like this song. You should put it out. We'll do a video. We'll do this. We'll do that." So clearly we did hit that moment in time together that day.
So when Aussie's sitting there and he's hearing, obviously he'd heard the song before it came around, but did he do the lyrics in that, you know, in that meeting, or has he already come with some ideas?
He had a couple of ideas, but 90% of it was done while he was sitting at Steve's kitchen table, you know? And I remember the moment when his head was down, and I'm not sure whether he was writing or whether he was thinking, but he looked up and he went, "I put you down and pick it up again, like crack cocaine." And me and Steve were like, "Well, there we have it. There's the title." Yeah.
Boom. Yeah. Because I mean, it's such a great sleazy riff. It's like the kind of riff that would prowl the streets at night. It's really real pure Aussie. But the other thing about it is when it goes into that kind of a bridge, is the sense of melody. Because the thing I think about Aussie is, I know he's seen as like the heavy metal vocalist, but he loves melody, doesn't he? He loves
all
the Beatles.
All of that melody. Yeah. All of it. It's all him. It's all him. And I'll tell you something that goes further. All his harmonies, they're all him, and they're in his head. Yeah, I've recorded a few times with Aussie now, and it's clear that when he's singing the lead vocal, he can also hear his harmony, because the moment you press stop, he goes, "Right, okay, go again. I've got the harmony." And it's all in his head. He is the king of melody. It's insane watching him do it. It's really cool. But then again, that separates a very successful rock singer from being an icon, which is what Aussie is.
Yeah, I totally agree, because as you discussed, it's a typical heavy metal Aussie song, but because of the melody, you could actually strip it back and the melody and the song would work as any genre, wouldn't it?
I could sit with Aussie, with me and him and an acoustic guitar and play it.
It would work. It would work,
wouldn't it? David Bowie once said, if you can't play it on a piano or an acoustic, it's not finished.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Now, the other thing that's interesting, because you wrote all these songs separately, is that I put on my notes here, because the next one up is It Comes to This. It's got to be the segue of the year. How it goes from crack cocaine.
That's really funny.
As it goes from that crack cocaine, it comes to this. The way it just turns on its head, and we're into another song. It's fantastic.
It's part fantasy, I'll say that. I kind of think it's like an extension of drowning. It came from that feeling of negativity and information overload. And sometimes I was left with a feeling of, I just want to sell it all. You see all this art behind me and, you know, all the trappings of success and living in Beverly Hills and all that shit.
Yeah.
I was having moments where I'm like, I just want to sell it all, get in my car and drive to the desert to find a more universe-based spiritual solution to the malaise that I'm feeling,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I hope people relate to that because it just felt like it's come to this. I can't take it anymore. That's the lyric. I can't take this anymore.
But the track is anything but malaise. It's such a driving rhythm with a super kind of really simple three note riff that floats over the top of that.
I had the video. There's a video coming out. No one's seen it, but I've seen a rough cut. It's coming out very soon. And I had the video in mind from the moment I wrote the song with Eric. That's an Eric Aldinius idea. He's a drummer, but he's an amazing, he likes the discordant yeah. things that features in that song. And I'm a huge Queens of the Stone Age fan. And it was all there in my head when we wrote that. I could see the video, which is basically Vanishing Point meets the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's a road movie. And I can't wait for people to see the video. It's exactly what I had in mind. And it fits the song perfectly.
It's fantastic. And because all the songs kind of segued, they do just move from one to the other, don't they? So as you wrote these songs, they obviously weren't written in the order that they finished up on the album. But
no.
So the sequencing here, as you sat down, and because it all follows a really great story.
Thank you.
You must have had great fun putting this together into the album.
I did. I mean, look, I started with about 30 not finished songs. They were, maybe it was a verse and a chorus, maybe it was a bridge. Sometimes it was just a bridge. And when I eventually decided, okay, I'm going to put a cohesive album together, I revisited all those 30 ideas. I pulled about six that were strong and I completely redid them. You know, I just took the tempo and maybe the loop or the bass line or whatever, redid it, made those into songs, and then wrote the rest of the album after that. And the sequencing, you know, the sequencing was actually very organic, because what I noticed the other day is it goes a song that I sing, a song that the guest sings, a song that I sing, a song that the guest sings. And that was not intentional. I was sequencing the music to tell the story dystopian kind of observation. And it just so happened it all fell into place nicely. But I did have a lot of fun sequencing it, yeah.
Well, the next one, The Eyes Have It.
It's a good story about this one.
Yeah, this is a real snarl in the vocal delivery, almost a bit of Sex Pistols in there, isn't there, as well? It's a very powerful song, and God, the guitar sound, you know, and you've got some great guests on this as well.
Thank you. So this was Al Jurgensen from Ministry, and people don't really know this because there's no credits, but I've written a bunch of songs with Ministry over the last two Ministry albums.
Oh, wow.
And so, and yeah, me and Al just kind of trade. I'll write songs for Ministry whenever I'm asked. I think they're a wonderful band. Yeah. I love Al Jurgensen. But it was time for me to return the favor. So I said, Al, I'm doing a solo album. I need you to sing a song. He said, no problem. So I sent him what eventually became Dystopia, which we're going to get to, obviously.
Yeah.
So I sent in that. And 2 months later, I said, Al, you know, what's going on with these vocals? I need to get this song done. He said, oh, yeah, I've got some lyrics. I just need you to resend me the song because my phone's messing up or something. So I resent him Dystopia. And he said, oh, shit, I've been writing to this riff. And he sent me back a Ministry riff It was only 16 bars long, and his phone had been cycling it.
Yeah.
So he'd written the whole song to a completely different riff that I didn't have a full song.
Yeah.
So I ran home, I took that riff, I made it into the music that you hear, and went back the next day, and he laid his vocal down, and that became The Eyes Have It.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's got, it's a great driving song. And John Five's on there as well, isn't he, from Crew?
Yeah,
and,
that was literally, once Al had done his vocal, Al said, you know who'd be great on this song is John Five. And I happened to have John's number, and he's a friend. So I went, I might be able to make that happen. And I texted John. He said, I'm a huge Ministry fan. And suddenly we've got Al Jolson and John Five.
Yeah, it's fantastic. The next one, Dystopia. This is got to be probably the fastest track on the album. It's a great riff, though, isn't it? It's just... And obviously it's a kind of, it's dystopia. It's kind of a negative kind of lyric in a way, but the music itself is really joyous and uplifting.
Well, like I say, that music was originally written for Al Jurgensen. I thought that was the song that Al was going to sing on. So now I wrote a completely new song for Al, and I got Dystopia. It was all finished. It was just a song without a vocal.
Yeah.
And I did contemplate calling some other people and maybe getting another guest. And then I thought, to be honest, I thought, screw it, I'll sing it. I've got enough anger in me to be able to sing it. And I wrote the lyrics. Didn't take long. The lyrics were, it was obviously meant to be. And then I recorded that vocal at Al's studio the same day that Al recorded his vocals for The Eyes Have It, so that I could use his vocal chain, which is what gives it that kind of nasty, aggressive feeling. And the other thing is, it almost at that point was like a filler track, because I was like, look, I've got this song. I may as well sing it. I wasn't paying much attention. And when I sang it, it just came out of me so violently. And it suddenly became one of my favourite tracks on the album, you know.
Well, it's the perfect song for a Friday night for anywhere in the world, actually. or maybe everyone should play it before they leave the house in the morning.
Get you, wake you up.
Absolutely brilliant. Now, the next one is Inside the Watch. This is one of my favourite tracks on the album. There's a lot going on in this one, isn't there? And you've got Steve Vai, Corey Taylor's on it. and there's that really grungy riff and treated vocal and stuff, but the chorus is fantastic. So how did this come together? This sounds like quite an epic song.
Oh, it was always meant to be an epic, and it was always meant to sound like two different songs.
Yeah, it does. Together. Yeah.
The second section, which is Steve Vai's solo, is a nod of the hat to an English band called the Wild Hearts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yep, I'm a massive Ginger Wild Heart fan and all things Wild Hearts. And their thing is amazing chord changes and key changes. So I wrote this section of music thinking, what would Ginger do? You know, and there's three key changes. And I had that one section and I left it. I then had this grungy loop driven, industrial, I guess.
Yeah.
Sound going on, and Corey is a good friend of mine and one of the greatest voices in rock and roll, you know. And so I said, "Would you sing?" And he said, "Yes." I didn't tell him what to write. I didn't give him any instruction. I sent him that portion of the song, and what you're listening to on the record is exactly what he sent back. The guy is phenomenal. All the harmonies, all the treatment. That's what he sent back.
Wow.
And then I literally stuck the two sections together with that little bit of ethereal music in the middle.
Yeah.
And thought that was a song where I thought, well, I'm not going to attempt to do a three key change solo over this. Who would be good? Well, Steve Vai. So Steve, being the wonderful man that he is, he said, absolutely, send it to me. And I sent it to him, and that's what he did. And I glued it all together in the mix, and now we have this epic 6-minute crazy Goliath of a song.
because that's a huge part of how this album's come together, is obviously your skills and vision of using the technology and, you know, as you say, the programming and stuff. Because, right. You know, you saw the finished,
yes.
You saw what you were trying to get to.
That's one of the reasons that it is a Billy Morrison solo album, just because I don't sing everything on it. I'm all over this thing. The vision of the album, it's one thing to write a song and then, or even write 12 songs, but to be able to put guest appearances on it and make it cohesive and glue it all together, that's why it's a Billy Morrison solo album. The music, all of it, is what touches me, the genres that I like. The glue across it all is me. And so, you know, I urge people to look past the fact that, oh my God, Corey Taylor's singing this song. Yes, he's singing this song that I had a vision for.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's an amazing song. As I say, it's one of my favorites, absolutely. And Puppets on a String, it's got a really great fast metal intro. And this is again about feeling left in the dark. There's lots of anger and frustration in this, isn't there?
Yeah. That is probably about as political as I will ever get. I don't align myself one side or the other, but I do feel that we are asked to make decisions based on information that just isn't true. We are never told the truth, the real facts. So how can we make decisions if even the people that we're voting for are really just puppets? They're puppets to a higher level of control and power that we don't even understand. So that, yes, it's a negative observation on how the world's political structure has been built, which is basically everyone are puppets on strings being pulled by things and people we have no idea about. And Puppets on a String is the song that I call the one with the weird timing, because guess who wrote that riff? The original riff was written by Eric, the drummer.
Yeah.
And because he's a drummer, he likes to show off that not everything has to be 4-4.
Yeah.
So,
fair enough.
Yeah. And I liked the riff, but you should have seen me trying to sing it.
But as you say, I mean, the lyrics might be slightly political, and we've mentioned so far that there's, you know, dystopia and thoughts about information overload. But musically, it's very uplifting. The whole album is a feel-good musically. It's a kind of paradox in a way.
All the music that makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up is uplifting music. AC/DC, the Sex Pistols, the Wild Hearts. So musically, I'm going to write a sonic structure that makes me feel good or makes me feel something. Like, I just want to feel energy when I listen to music. So that was the idea behind all of these songs.
Which is probably why I keep thinking of Friday night when I put it on.
Listen, if I've written the Great Friday Night album, I am so happy.
And the next one is it's not a change in direction. It's just a change in textures, just like a movie, because you've got DMC on here. But this is, I love this. I love the programming of it. I love the synthesizers, the keys, the rhythm. You know, it's kind of gives me an image of like rain-soaked streets, neon lights late at night again. Still
it's
Friday.
Funny that. We're shooting a video for that song as well, and we're going to shoot it on the streets of Brooklyn. So maybe it'll be raining and we'll
Yeah. Well, I think it needs to be. But I love the chorus. And you've got Gary Newman's daughter on this. Is that right?
Persia. Yeah, Persia Newman. So it's no secret. I'm a huge fan of old school hip hop. I went to see NWA. I saw Public Enemy. To me, hip hop was just punk rock. That's all it was. Punk rock was always about an attitude and saying something worth saying in the first place. And that's what all those hip hop pioneers did. They did not care about the music business. That was their punk rock. So I gravitate to that. So, you know, you add in the fact that I have a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer as a friend you know, yeah. Daryl, DMC, basically invented hip hop. You know,
that's true.
So that was a groove. All the programming, yeah, I'm super proud of the programming. I sit for hours in my studio here playing with hip hop beats, you know, but I do like to kick in a big chorus. And I had seen Persia perform with her dad, Gary. And she did this amazing, like, Eastern melody, swirly thing. And I said to Dee, that would be cool in the chorus if we get... So I texted Gary, do you think Persia would be up for singing the chorus? And what's funny is, like, you know, at the time she was, I think, 16, 17 maybe. I said, do you think she'd be up for doing this? And she said yes. And then when I saw her, I said, when I asked you to do this song, did you know who DMC was? And she went, no. I said, do you realize he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? No. Like, she just, like, she's oblivious. It was great.
But it's her voice adds this kind of angelic, as you say, atmospheric feel to it, doesn't it? But, you know, we've got these huge guitar chords and lots of stuff. Yeah. I actually put in my notes that you must have had a lot of fun mixing this.
Loads of fun. And the thing is, the song has it touches on the Me Too movement, the Hollywood casting couch, you know, scenario that is so disgusting and no one will talk about it. You know, and so Dee's lyrics, the samples in there, it's just meant to be a slightly edgy observation of Hollywood, you know?
Yeah, fantastic. Now, the next one, Sound of Freedom, was the one that, because I know we're going to mention Billy Idol in a moment, but the Sound of Freedom sounded like it was kind of, because this is one of my favorite albums by Billy.
Oh, thank you. I wrote a lot
of
that.
I know.
That's right.
I know. And that's what made me think the Sound of Freedom had a kind of Billy Idol vibe to it.
Yeah, it did. That is my homage to 90s Brit rock. So, you know, obviously Billy would be in there, but it was my chance to do my best Liam Gallagher. You know, Liam is one of my heroes as a frontman. I think he is fantastic. And it's that whole, there's a little Stone Roses in there, but there's also a bit of The Mission and The Cult. Yeah. And it was also something that was really in my wheelhouse. When I was writing that music, I was singing along in my head and I thought, no, this is, Billy could have sung it. He could have sung it. But I was like, I want to sing this one because I can do my Liam Gallagher. And
it
felt right.
No, it's great. It's got it's uplifting chorus, very socially aware, and of course that great guitar solo in it from yours truly.
I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun doing that solo.
Yeah, I mean, when you on that particular solo, what guitar were you playing? Just out of interest,
I played two. I played it, the main solo was done on a Les Paul. I've got a beautiful 59 reissue from the custom shop, so I played that. But I also took a Steve Vai Ibanez.
Oh, yeah.
And played the harmony, the gem. I played the harmony. Yeah, because you got the dive bomb and, I also would never do a twin guitar solo on the same guitar. You want to.
Yes, of course. Get
that little texture. I was even using the single coil on that.
And the next one is Mr. Dream, which does feature Billy Idol. It's a fast rocker, terrific. Again, another one of my faves. I love it. It's about 2.5 minutes in when it drops back to the spoken word by Billy. It's very thought-provoking. He sounds like he had a ball singing this.
He did, and it took him about half an hour. There's another icon. There's another icon. So I wrote the lyric based off an idea that Steve Stevens gave me.
Yeah.
Mr. Dream is this scuzzy, horrible, risen from the ashes of hell character that has a lot of charisma and vanity and draws people in, much like a lot of politicians, I could think. Billy loved that character. He wanted to be Mr. Dream. So he came in. He'd already learned. I did a version of the song where I sang it, obviously, because I have to show Billy.
Yeah.
This is the melody. This is the phrasing. And the dude is an icon. He came in and took him about half an hour, two or three takes, just alternates. He had a blast doing it. And it came out really well. I'm very happy. The thing with Billy Idol that you learn is his voice is so iconic and so specific. You need to leave space. So that's why all the verses are dropped down. There's a lot of space. And his timbre,
yeah,
just comes right to the forefront.
No, it's absolutely, I've got to say, it's one of my favorite tracks. It's excellent. Absolutely love that one. And the next one is We Are the Dead. And this has got like an electronic backing, another Billy vibe to me. But it's almost like pop dance at the start. It's very different to the feel of the other albums before, of course, the metal grungy guitar comes in.
But so one of my producer friends said, it sounds like really nasty Men Without Hats or Men, whatever that band was, right?
So
look, We Are the Dead, it's a love song. I wanted to write a love song, you know, for my girlfriend. But I'm not a subscriber of the traditional love song. Mm-hmm. And the concept of the strength of love that I'm singing about feels eternal and beyond. It feels like even if we die, that connection, that love will go forever beyond the grave.
Yeah.
So that's how I end up singing. You know, the lyrics in the verses are from my heart. And also I was quite pleasantly surprised at the performance on that song, because I can sing Drowning or Dystopia easily. You know, I just scream that shit. But on this song, I had to actually sing it, and it came out okay. I was
performance.
But the chorus, it comes out of nowhere and starts with that chant, "We are the dead and we'll live forever." So what I'm singing is, even when we're dead and gone, our love will live forever.
How superb is that? Yeah, as you say, that has got to be one of the most unlikely love song titles.
Yes, that's what I was going for. That. Yeah, it's a love song called We Are the Dead. What?
Brilliant. And then we change dramatically for the last track, which is Chasing Shadows, which is features Linda from Four Non Blondes. This is just achingly beautiful, isn't it?
Composed on
the piano.
I'm extremely proud of this, and I'll tell you why. First of all, Linda Perry doesn't do this kind of thing normally. Her display cabinet is full of Grammys. She's one of the most prolific and successful songwriters of our time. And she doesn't just pop up on people's albums, but she's a very close friend. I've known her for a long, long time. And I said, in theory, would you sing a song on my album? And she said, send me the song. So if you can imagine how nervous I was, because again, I wrote the whole thing, lyric, melody, everything. So I had to sing this thing. So there is a version which no one will ever hear of me singing that song. And I sent it to Linda. Even doing that, I was nervous because it's Linda Perry. She's written some of the greatest pop songs of our time. And I expected her to say, okay, fine, we'll come over to my studio and we'll rip this apart and build it back. And she responded with, this is a perfect song. I don't want to change a thing. I'll sing it as it is. And that's what she did. So as a songwriter, that one is very important to me because I wrote it all. And there were apparently, according to Linda, there was nothing wrong with it.
Well, Linda's absolutely 100% correct. There's nothing wrong with it. But this also has great guitar on it. This is you again, isn't it?
It is me. And Linda pushed me to do that because it didn't have, you know, the lead
break? Yeah.
It didn't have that. And she pushed me. She said, look, we'd mixed it already. And she said, I love it, but I think you, meaning me, can do something, think Mott the Hoople, think All the Young Dudes. And that came from Linda, and I went back into the studio with the mixed song and put that lead over it. And she was absolutely right. She knew what the song needed.
And I think it's because you're the creator of the song, and you're playing the lead solo, you're using the notes to tap into the meaning of the words. And I think 100%. That's why it works so well.
Thank you. And I was again, it was serve the song, serve the lyrics.
Yeah.
Linda's beautiful. What she did was absolutely stunning. So serve that and don't overstep. And I'm happy to say it came out sounding good.
Well, this album, The Morrison Project, is a perfect example of why the album will never die out, because each of these songs taken out separately to be streamed on their own will not give you the vision and the feel for all of these 12 songs put together and played in the order that you sequenced them.
Thank you.
I think that's
much.
What came across. I mean, the guy that produced it, he's done a fantastic job, hasn't he? I mean, the sound of this album is just off the scale.
Yeah. So I produced the whole album and Barry Poynter mixed it.
Right. Oh, sorry. Barry mixed it. Yeah.
Barry, he absolutely knocked this out of the park, because he gave it the cohesive structure that all this crazy mixed genre music needed. And it's all down to him.
Yeah, because that's why it works so well, I think. And I really mean this. I've played it quite a few times. Obviously, I've got like an advanced copy. I haven't seen the actual physical album yet, but it's just, this deserves to do so well. As I say, is the Friday night album of the 2024.
I'm grateful, Phil. I'm really grateful and I'm proud of it. And thank you so much for the support.
Now, so when it could work, welcome, because you do so many things. Where would you like people to find you or connect with you? A website or social media?
I mean, these days it's Google, isn't it? Just Google.
Yes. Yeah. So
there's a ton of stuff. The website is billymorrison.com. It's not hard. On social media, it's Billy Morrison. So I think wherever you're trying to connect with me, just type my name and you'll find me.
Okay. Finally, as I come to the end of the interview, what if you had to think of, say, three albums that had influenced you in your life to get you where you are now, or maybe made you pick up the album, guitar for the first time, what would they be?
It would be Never Mind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols. It would be Earth Versus the Wild Hearts by the Wild Hearts. And it would be any of the Bon Scott era AC/DC albums.
Absolutely brilliant. Okay, and the album's out on April the 19th. Okay, and people can be able to buy that from wherever they like.
It's wherever they like. It's vinyl, it's CD, it's all things, and it's all everywhere.
And make sure everybody watching or listening to this that you buy the vinyl or the CD, the physical record, to be connected as close as you can to the artist. And will you be doing any live stuff?
I'm going to have to jump because I've got a 9:40 interview.
Sorry, yeah.
But the answer is no, because I can't sing Crack Cocaine like Ozzy and I can't sing Chasing Shadows like Linda Perry.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much, Billy. Thanks for all of your time today. It's been fantastic. And hopefully the album's going to do really well, and stay safe, and I'll talk to you hopefully in the future.
Thank you so much for your support, Phil. Take it easy, buddy.
So a huge thank you to my guest, Billy Morrison. And the album, The Morrison Project, is out on April the 19th, 2024. And it's a fantastic album. It's observational. It's full of energy, and as I think I said to you in the interview, it's probably one of the best Friday night albums of the year. It's got all sorts of people on it. Ozzy Osbourne's on it, Steve Vai's on it, Steve Stevens, John B, cast of thousands. But it's definitely Billy Morrison's solo album. He sings fantastically on it, and the songwriting, the production, the mixing, everything about it, absolutely loved it. And as I said towards the end of the interview, what became apparent when listening to this album is the art of the album, the way that these 12 songs are stitched together, the way they segue from one to the other, works so well. It's just perfect art form, but it's a wonderful album full of crunchy riffs and great rhythms and fantastic, as I said, production. And I have to say, I could pick any track out here, but the one with Ozzy, Crack Cocaine, is, as he said as Billy said in the interview, it's kind of like the Ozzy Osbourne track that you've never heard before. It's just fantastic. The pinched harmonics, everything about it. Anyway, check out the album. It's probably out by the time you watch this, but it's well worth a listen. So I hope it does well. Thank you for watching. Thank you for being here. Remember, music is the healer and the doctor. Stay safe. Keep spinning those discs. And I shall see you all very, very soon.